cookbook, Gary Knoll's brand new book, The Healing Foods Cookbook, a $50 pledge, 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. This is WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. $1 million loan. Nobody makes it on their own without $1 million loan. To cast the first stone, you need $1 million loan. Every ascension to a throne. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
Let's deal with the real issues. That the rich are getting richer, that we are moving toward an oligarchic form of society where a handful of billionaires control the economy as a result of Citizens United, control to a significant degree our political system, and, may I say, control our media.
But they don't control WBAI. We do. Become a WBAI buddy, a monthly sustainer to WBAI. Go to give2WBAI.org and help strengthen independent, listener-sponsored, non-corporate WBAI in New York. And thank you.
And you are listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. If you missed any of the preceding Gary Knoll show, you can hear it on our archives in about 5 or 10 minutes. And coming up next is Hour of the Wolf, and I'm Ken Gale. I'll be subbing for Jim Freund today. And so it's also going to be the return of Nuff Said, the show I did from 1993-2007, and occasionally I do for Jim Freund. So here is the old Nuff Said theme. Those were the Tearjerkers, a band out of Belfast from back in the 70s. And today we'll be talking about the origins of comic books and the origins of a lot of the movies that we're watching these days. You know, nothing is created in a vacuum. And my guest is Anthony Tolan. How are you, Tony?
Just fine. And yourself, Ken?
I'm surviving so far.
It's been many, many years since we last saw each other.
It has been. And should we tell the listeners what you were wearing the first time we met?
Go ahead. I remember.
Tony,
The shirt was very bright red.
The shirt was very bright red, and you were wearing a blonde wig. And
I was the Golden Age Green Lantern, Alan Scott.
Yes, you were.
Which will, by the way, be featured in some of our conversations later, especially involving Alfred Bester.
Yes, right.
Since this is a show about, since The Hour of the Wolf is about science fiction generally. But yes, it was at the 1973 Phil Suling New York Comic Art Convention, the costume ball, costume contest, and but anyway, as you started out to say, comic book superheroes were not created in a vacuum. And the legendary comic book creators like Siegel and Shuster and Bob Kane and Bill Finger and Will Eisner and Simon and Kirby spent their childhoods reading pulp magazines. In fact, Jack Kirby, to his dying day, collected pulps and said he was, his personal hobby were pulps. He really didn't collect comics, but he loved the pulps from his childhood, especially the science fiction pulps.
And I got to see an exhibit of science fiction pulp covers not that long ago. And I was amazed in looking at it. I realized that, the comic book artists I grew up with, well, this is what they grew up with. And I could see that their idea of this is what an alien looks like was formed by these. And so I felt as if I was looking at Kurt Swan artwork and Gil Kane artwork. Even though they were just little boys when these covers came out.
Well, of course, also as an in-between in those areas were Julie Schwartz and Mort Weisinger and Jack Schiff. Jack Schiff and Mort Weisinger had edited Thrilling Wonder Stories for Thrilling Publications and also edited The Black Bat and Phantom Detective. And Julie Schwartz, of course, had been a science fiction writer's agent for many of the top science fiction writers. So Julie and Mort published one of the very first science fiction fanzines. And
The Time Traveler.
Yep. And, Siegel and Shuster, Jerry Siegel was a huge fan of The Shadow. Also a fan of Doc Savage, but much more so The Shadow.
Now, Jerry Siegel created Superman.
Right. And Bill Finger was another huge fan of The Shadow. Bill Finger, when he was interviewed in the Steranko History of Comics, the first volume, recalled that his first Batman story was a takeoff on a Shadow story, in his words. And when I started publishing the reprinting the Shadow novels and licensed double novel trade paperbacks authorized by the copyright owner Condé Nast. Will Murray reminded me of that quote, wrote an article and mentioned that, and I remembered it, and then I became pretty obsessed with finding which novel that was. And no one had ever bothered to check to see which it was. And one Saturday night on the phone, Will and I started, combining our memories and figuring out what it couldn't be. And I started digging pulps out. And, we had figured it would take days to find it, but it turned out to take about 20 minutes. Will thought it might very likely be a novel by... the story in Detective 27 might be based on a Theodore Tinsley Shadow novel.
Now, Detective 27 is the first appearance of Batman back in 1939.
Right. And As I said, Will thought it might be based on a Tinsley novel because it was just more linear and more direct, you know, start to end plot, where Gibson tended to get very layered and convoluted. You know, Gibson was a magician who loved doing magic shows, loved doing misdirection in his novels. And it turned out to be Theodore Tinsley's first shadow novel, the first shadow novel that was not written by Gibson after Gibson had written more than 100 straight. And it was, the amazing thing is, I immediately realized, paging through it, that it was not just, it wasn't actually, as Bill Finger had said, that it was a takeoff. It was actually an all-out adaptation. Every character, every incident, every plot point. The only things new in it were the names Batman and the Batman costume. It was a scene-for-scene adaptation. It was actually far closer to the original Shadow novel than Walter Gibson's comic book adaptations of his own novels. And in my article, Foreshadowing the Batman, in Volume 9 of my Shadow reprints, which is still available, it's my all-time best-selling volume.
Yeah, I bet.
And well, Roy Thomas said on the back cover that, you know, Will and I had rewritten the history of Batman. Roy noted that we all knew that Batman was inspired by the Shadow. We just didn't know how much he was inspired by the Shadow. And as I said, the first novel is just a complete adaptation of that story. And there were at least a couple dozen other, you know, Batman stories in the Golden Age that were strongly influenced by Shadow novels. But nothing like that first one. Shadow number 9 had two novels, Lingo, which was one of Walter Gibson's great novels, which featured the Shadow's Yellow Boomerang, or the introduction of the Shadow's Yellow Boomerang, which was a yellow boomerang connected to a cable. Now, of course, and that's obviously the inspiration for the Batarang.
I don't know if I'd go that far to say that, because Gardner Fox wrote the first story that had a Batarang in it, and he was a huge fan of all different kinds of weapons.
But also Gardner Fox also wrote the story that had the that introduced Batman's Bat Gyro, the first Batplane, which was also strongly influenced by, you know, obviously lifted from the Shadow's Auto Gyro.
That I'll see. But the fact that Gardner Fox was into ancient weapons of all kinds, his study was full of books about all ancient weapons. He created Hawkman in 1939, and he used lots of ancient weapons. So Gardner Fox was into that. So
right, but the thing is, yellow boomerang or a batarang would not work, either one, if it was connected to a cable. Boomerangs have to be able to spin,
yes,
which they can't do if you have a cable. So it's visual, but there's no boomerang connected to a cable in real life.
That's true.
And the Shadow's yellow boomerang, just like the batarang, was connected to a cable. But anyway, that's the first novel in that volume, and the second one was Partners of Peril, which was adapted for the case of the chemical syndicate. It's even a chemical syndicate in the Shadow novel. And in fact, in my introduction to the story, I spent a half a page of text detailing the plot similarities, and I could have gone maybe even a whole page, and it's only a six-page comic book story. I didn't want to ruin the novel for people reading it, so I left out a number of key things.
It's amazing to think that the Batman started with six pages.
Yeah, and that an 80-page Shadow text novel was reduced to six pages, which you probably could not have done with a Walter Gibson novel because of the layers of plotting in a Gibson novel. But and then also in the same volume, we had a story by the same writer of Partners of Peril, the fill-in Shadow writer, Theodore Tinsley, called The Grim Joker, about a white-faced crime boss. And a year later, in my second Foreshadowing the Batman volume, which was featured Voodoo Trail and Death's Harlequin, the Shadow fought a sinister clown. Tinsley, another story by Tinsley. Tinsley did the backup story in The Whisperer. By the way, The Whisperer, who I've also reprinted the first 14 Whisperer novels in Sanctum Books editions, The Whisperer's secret identity was Police Commissioner James W. Gordon, whose nickname was Wildcat, which probably inspired another Bill Finger, the name at least, another Bill Finger character.
And I should mention, you know, these things of clowns and things that we're talking about the 1930s. When circuses were incredibly popular. I mean, nowadays, you kind of have just a handful of circuses, and you know what goes on in movies has sort of outdone what the people do in circuses. Even wrestling sometimes does.
Right.
But back then,
circuses were also
circuses were huge. Everybody went to the circus. Everybody wanted to be in the circus.
And circus. Acrobatic and aerial costumes did a lot to influence superhero costumes.
Oh, they certainly did. People talked about that all the time. And the different kinds of capes, where you have the square cape and the round cape, and people in circuses had all different kinds of capes depending on what they were doing. If the cape was part of the act, it had to be something that didn't interfere with it, but still looked cool. And so there was all different shapes.
And by the way, getting back to the Golden Age Green Lantern costume I wore when we met, I discovered when wearing that costume why the Green Lantern was constantly getting knocked out from behind.
Yes.
With wooden clubs, because the Golden Age Green Lantern costume gave you no peripheral vision. It cut off your vision except for like the 90 degrees in front of you. Like the 200, you had no side vision at all in that costume. Might have looked good in comic books, but
That little flaring of the cape that behind the head, and
not a little flaring; it goes up like almost to the top of the head.
I remember talking to
above your eyes. So
George Perez designed the Nightwing costume, and he had something like that. And I remember talking to him about it, where he was very conscious of the peripheral vision, should it stick up above the eyes.
By the way, you do remember who suggested the name for Dick Grayson's Nightwing identity. It was the same person who designed the color scheme of the Nightwing's original costume.
Was that Gafford?
No, me.
That was you?
Yes. Marv Wolfman has even acknowledged it in interviews and such. I was, of course, the cover colorist on New Teen Titans, and my late wife, Adrienne Roy, had been the interior colorist on Titans from the first issue. And I came in one day, and the editor, Len Wein, mentioned, you know, we had this, that they changed their mind. DC originally was going to move Robin into Teen Titans as Dick Grayson and create a new kid sidekick for Batman. And then they'd gotten permission to create a new Robin and give a new adult identity to Dick Grayson. And Len said they were trying to think of a name that would be bird-like, but, you know, and the problem is all the good, more adult, more threatening bird names were already being used in New Teen Titans. Raven and Hawk, you know, and such. And I first suggested Nighthawk, and then, you know, after the DC Western character. And Len said, yeah, that would be great, except it was already being used in Squadron Supreme and Marvel.
Yeah, Marvel, yeah.
And I said, well, then how about Nightwing? And I said, at that very time, I said, you know, after Bruce Wayne and Alfred, Dick Grayson's biggest influence, you know, male role model and mentor was Superman. and Superman was Nightwing with Jimmy Olsen and Flamebird when they were the Batman and Robin of Kandor. And, of course, that was back when Superman and Batman were friends, when it was a much kinder, more caring DC universe.
Yeah.
And Len liked the
name.
There's
a great Facebook page called DC Comics When They Were Fun.
Yeah. Well, Len liked the name, and Marv Wolfman hated the name initially. And I guess, you know, about 15 or 20 names, suggested names, went up to the legal department at DC. And the only name that legal would approve was Nightwing. So that's how Nightwing got his name. And then George had designed the costume without coloring. I remember going in, and Tom Zucco had done some suggested color schemes for it, and I started doing some, and I kept saying, look, I think maybe this really dark navy costume with a middle value blue, and Marv and George didn't like the idea, and I did a number of things, and some they suggested, and then finally in production, I said, well, look, let me show you what I have in mind, and I colored what was Nightwing, and the moment they saw it, they hadn't liked it from my description of it, but they immediately liked it, and that's how Nightwing got that particular color scheme in his costume. You know, DC was a much more, you know, when I started on staff at DC, there were 33 staff employees, including the payroll department upstairs. So there were 27 of us in production and editorial and such, and that also included the president, the vice president, the business manager, and the production manager, right, and their secretaries. I mean, that was eight of them. And the darkroom photographer, and then there were, the remaining people were pretty much evenly divided between editorial and production. And we all had to be able to be jack of all trades, and everyone knew each other. DC was an incredibly casual, family-type community at that time. You know, I know about 10 years ago, DC had 17 vice presidents and 5 staff attorneys. I mean, that was almost the size of our staff back started, of everybody. But anyway, it's one of my very minor, legacies of my 20-plus years at DC was suggesting the name Nightwing, which is still being used.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Ken Gale, and I'm talking with Anthony Tolan, the publisher and editor of Shadow Pulps and Doc Savage and a whole lot of other stuff. And I'm substituting for Jim Freund's Hour of the Wolf. We've been using the word pulp as if we assume that everybody listening knows what in the world we're talking about.
Well, pulps were generally about 128, sometimes more, page magazines. The height and width of a comic book, as I said, much thicker, generally, 3/8 or a 1/2 inch thick. And the premise was, going back to the first pulp, Argosy, that the story was more important than the paper that it was printed on. And the publisher of Argosy, Muncie, started publishing, I think the original issues were a nickel, and it was the same price as other magazines, but it was 3 times as many pages and 3 times as much story for the same price. And Walter Gibson pointed out that a lot of the reasons for the differentiation between flicks and pulps were because of the advertising. Slick magazines could reproduce photographs, so you would have photographs of cars and, beautiful models and such. And pulps were pretty much restricted to line art for the illustrations. And the pulps gave us so many of our popular iconic characters. I mean, Tarzan debuted in pulp magazines in 1912, and in 1919, Zorro debuted in All Story Weekly, the same magazine that had introduced Tarzan. You had Conan, who debuted in Weird Tales. You have, of course, the Shadow and Doc Savage and the Spider, and and The Phantom Detective and Operator 5, American Secret Service Ace. You have Iron Monroe, who was a John W. Campbell character in Astounding Science Fiction magazine, who was descended from Earthmen but had been born on the planet Jupiter, and because of the higher gravity of Jupiter, had a denser molecular structure and was near invulnerable and could leap long distances at a single bound. By the way, I recently, the things I've tried to do in my Shadow and Doc Savage reprints is to include as much bonus material and to give the best value for the money. You know, as it is, they were originally two novels for $12.95. They're now two novels for $14.95. We've been going for 10 years. But
don't mention prices anymore.
What? Okay, I won't.
Yes, can't mention prices in WBA.
Okay. I'm sorry, I did not know that, so I will not. But anyway, 2 years ago, I started reprinting the Iron Monroe stories from the early issues of Shadow Comics. And the first two were the very first comic book stories ever written by Otto Binder, and who later, of course, went on to become one of the great comic book writers and the Captain Marvel Golden Age writer, and also, of course, wrote Supergirl and Legion of Superheroes and Superman and a lot for DC. And then the after the first two stories, the ones Bender scripted, his successor, doing the only comic book scripting he ever did in his career, was Theodore Sturgeon, one of the great science fiction writers, and of course the also the person who wrote a couple of Star Trek scripts, including A Mock Time, which introduced the phrase "live long and prosper."
He also wrote westerns and romances, and I consider him one of the best American writers of the 20th century, any genre, not just science fiction, but one of the best writers, period.
In addition to the stories I reprinted, I even, you know, located a quote in a letter from Sturgeon to his mother in 1940, talking about how much he was enjoying comic book writing.
Hmm.
I really
wanted to go on a little bit about Theodore Sturgeon, because I think he's one of the he's starting to be forgotten, and his talent, whether it was in the story plots, but especially his characterization, his ability to write human relationships was amazing, and what he could do with just a few words is just so impressive. I would find myself rereading a paragraph over and over again just because it was so beautifully written. I highly recommend, if you can get a Theodore Sturgeon novel or a collection of short stories, get them, read them.
By the way, back when I was assistant production manager at DC, I got a letter from Theodore Sturgeon. And that's where I first learned he'd written the Iron Monroe stories in the Shadow, and he said he didn't have copies of them. And is there any way I could Xerox them for him, which I, of course, did. And then later I met him at the Minnesota Science Fiction Convention, and he was very grateful to, you know, have black and white Xeroxes of the stories, his comic book work.
Yeah.
But getting back to Batman for a moment, Ken, who was Batman's first recurring villain?
Uh-oh, that's got to be a trick question, or you wouldn't be asking me.
No, it's not.
Oh.
Detective Comics 29 and 30.
Oh, you mean Hugo Strange?
No.
Is that Hugo
Strange? It was Dr. Death.
Dr. Death, okay.
And Dr. Death, the stories were lifted to a large degree from the Voodoo Master stories about Dr. Rodal McQuino in the Shadow. And in, I think, the second Voodoo Master story, the Voodoo Master is trapped in a fiery building, as the Shadow manages to escape, and is supposedly dead, returns, and the third Voodoo Master story, badly burned. Same thing happened in the two Dr. Death stories, which had a lot of key plot points, but Dr. Death appears to die in a flaming building at the end of the first one and comes back badly scarred and out for revenge in the second one. That was reprinted in my second Foreshadowing the Batman volume, mm-hmm. in Shadow number 19, along with the Death Harlequin story about the Sinister Clown. And by the way, Sinister Clowns, you mentioned circuses, but there were a couple of Sinister Clowns in The Phantom Detective. Sinister Clowns were a staple of pulp fiction. And similarly, about 6 weeks before Batman number one came out, so it could have nothing, it could be total coincidence. But the Shadow radio show featured a story, The Laughing Corpse, was it? Which was about a substance that caused people to laugh themselves to death. And there had also been, I think, a Phantom Detective story in a Doc Savage novel about substances that caused people to laugh themselves to death. So again, these were the superheroes that, you know, the great early comic book creators enjoyed in their childhoods, and it's where they learned what a superhero was. I mean, that's why they, you know, it was a new medium, but Stan Lee and Jack Kirby and Will Eisner and Bill Finger and Bob Kane, you know, all remembered their enjoyment of superheroes in the pulps.
And I recently was watching a documentary on the history of science fiction movies.
Mm-hmm.
And the very first science fiction movie back in 1902, a whopping 24 minutes long, which was very long in those days, was directed and featured a stage magician.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're talking about, you know, Walter Gibson having written so many Shadow novels and being a stage magician and knowing how to do misdirection and things like that. Now you see him, now you don't. But special effects for a science fiction movie done by a stage magician was just a natural. And again, I think, you know, we're kind of jaded with what can be done with computer-generated imaging and stuff like that, where people were doing magic in front of other people on stage. And so naturally they would gravitate to film, and naturally they would gravitate to science fiction and heroic novels and things like that. I like to give a context in where these things were created in. Because, again, nothing's in a vacuum.
And on that same matter, Walter Gibson was, of course, the biographer and ghostwriter for Harry Houdini.
Right.
And when Houdini died in 1926 on Halloween, which is National Magic Day now because of it, all of his secret notebooks were turned over to Walter for a while to finish a couple of books on Houdini that he'd already been working on. And so, you know, Walter was very clear that the secrets of Houdini did not die with Houdini. A number of them died with Walter.
Hmm.
But as I noted in Shadow Volume 9, the Dark Knight inherited the Shadow's talent for escapes from diabolical death traps, beginning with the Partners of Peril's glass gas chamber. Batman's mastery of escape was a legacy from Houdini to his biographer Walter Gibson and on to Bill Finger via the Shadow.
Right. It does explain why the villains didn't just shoot the people they had under their power. They had to put them in a death trap, in the Shadow and then in Batman.
Movie serials also had the, you know, the death traps.
And
Houdini, of course, had done a movie serial, you know, as a master of escape, where he was a crime fighter.
So again, this is all a context. You had You know, well, what's the word I'm looking for? You had touring people doing all kinds of stuff, doing magic and doing singing and doing everything for vaudeville. And vaudeville was basically, you know, cheap entertainment for the average person. And magic was a part
of that. Until movies came about, which were even cheaper entertainment.
Right. And, you can, instead of having to pay all these people to travel around, you could just send a reel of film. And
then came along network radio,
yeah.
Which in exchange for listening to the sponsor's message, you could get the entertainment and the biggest stars for free. And I think, you know, radio really cemented, you know, this nation of immigrants into an American nationality, because suddenly, regardless of what nationality you were listening to the exact same entertainment every night. You were listening to Jack Benny and, you know, Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy and Amos and Andy. And,
right. There's a shared culture.
There's a shared culture. You know, you had, you know, you talked about what you heard the last night over the, you know, at the office cooler at work the next day or on the job, construction or farming or whatever you did. And, for the first time in the world, people, you know, across this country were sharing the same entertainment and hearing the same jokes. You know, I mean, you might hear the same jokes in vaudeville, you know, months apart, you know, when the act came to your city. But you'd hear the exact same jokes. It also, of course, led to a huge need for writers. You know, comedy writers and drama writers to turn out a tremendous amount of entertainment every week. But, I mean, I don't think you can separate just how important the medium of radio was in uniting, you know, and creating an American heritage.
And speaking of radio, you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. And, of course, the Shadow began on radio as a host, right? He wasn't
as a sinister narrator of mystery stories on CBS's Street and Smith Detective Story Hour, Detective Story Magazine Hour. And basically, Detective Story Magazine came out on Friday, so Street and Smith decided to promote the magazine the night before with a network radio show where they would adapt one of the short stories from the magazine into, radio format. And when none of those shows survive in recorded form. But six of them were adapted as two-reel, 20-minute, 22-minute two-reelers by Universal Pictures. And they survive. At least five of the six survive. So we can really get a sense of what the show was. And for those of your listeners who listen to Whistler episodes on Max Schmid's Golden Days of Radio show on WBAI.
It's Sundays from 7 to 9.
It's remarkably the same format, with the Shadow talking to the subconscious of the murderer or the criminal and kind of taunting his subconscious and such. So what happened is that radio listener, Street and Smith had really hoped it would promote the sales of Detective Story magazine, but the Shadow proved a lot more memorable than the show itself, and instead people were confusing newsstand dealers by asking for that Shadow Detective magazine. And so Street and Smith's general manager and circulation director, Bill Ralston, decided, well, if they're asking for a Shadow magazine, let's give it to them. And they didn't think it would succeed, and actually pretty much that year the only new magazines that really succeeded were Ballyhoo and the Shadow magazine.
Right. We're talking about the Depression.
What?
We're talking about the height of the Depression.
Yeah, this was 1930, April of 31, that the first issue of, or March of 31, it was cover dated April, that it went on sale.
So it was only a dime, but a lot of people didn't have a dime.
Right. But the thing is, it sold out and went into a second printing, which also sold out. And Walter Gibson had gotten the job to write The Shadow, and he was told if they liked his first novel, there'd probably be three more. Friedan Smith didn't think it would last beyond four issues, but they were afraid if they didn't publish it that someone else would jump on the name. And at that time, you couldn't, you know, copyright or trademark a radio broadcast. Or and so they published a magazine so they could trademark it and establish a copyright on the character. And, the first issue sold out, went into a second printing. The second issue sold out. It went monthly with the third issue, and 11 months later it went twice a month. And instead of writing four novels a year, Walter Gibson was writing 24 novels a year. Mm-hmm. He wrote 28 novels each of his first 2 years after getting that contract and was permanently like 6 months ahead of schedule. I will mention that the host of the guest host tonight of this show, Ken Gale, met Walter Gibson the same day I did, or the same night I did. And it was the Monday following the last day of the Marvel Comics Convention in 1975, and I think February. And
I think that was 76, February 76.
No, it was 75. You and I were still roommates.
We were roommates in 75.
Yeah. And you and I and Howard Bender went to it. And basically, back then, a bookstore, which is no longer around in Manhattan, called Murder, Inc., had a monthly symposium with at the Steinway Concert Hall, where they'd have a guest speaker who was a mystery writer. And that particular month, it was this guest speakers were Walter Gibson, a.k.a. Maxwell Grant, the writer of the Shadow novels, and John Nanovic, who was the editor of The Shadow and Doc Savage. And that's the first time I met Walter Gibson. And then a few months later, 5 months later, Walter and Jack Kirby were the guest of honor at the 1975 Phil Sloan Comic Art Convention. And a meeting of the first meeting of the Shadow Secret Society, moderated by Jim Steranko. The Shadow became this tremendous publishing phenomenon, and The Shadow was the only one of the hero pulps to be published twice a month. Doc Savage was monthly, Phantom Detective was monthly, Black Bat and Black Book Detective appeared quarterly. And, you know, one of the really interesting things there is that Detective Story magazine, which The Shadow had debuted as host on the radio version, went over the next few years from weekly to biweekly to monthly, while The Shadow magazine went from quarterly to twice a month during the same time. Also of interest.
Now, how did World War II's paper shortage affect the pulps and the advent of the comic book industry taking away some of their readers?
Well, it hurt the pulps a great deal. First off, publishers were restricted to maintain, to not increase their because of rationing. They had to stay within the limits of what they'd published before. And suddenly you had this very hot new medium of comic books, which were just selling 96 and 98% of the print runs and having much larger print runs. And also a 64-page comic used half the paper of a 128-page pulp magazine and cost the same price, 10 cents. And printing was pretty negligible back then. And so suddenly, publishers had to decide, do I keep publishing the pulps or do I move the paper allotments over to the comic books? And so The Shadow, Street and Smith, launched a Shadow comic book in January of 1940. They had delayed. Walter had been after them since at least 37, before Superman and Batman debuted, to get The Shadow into comic books. But at that time, Street and Smith did all of their printing in-house in the Street and Smith building and on, I think, 17th and 7th in the Chelsea section of Manhattan. It's pretty amazing to realize that, that back then they did the printing, the binding, the trucking, the warehousing, everything in one seven-story building in Manhattan. And the bottom two floors were for the heavy presses. You'd be in the editorial offices at that building, and they'd be shaking from the giant presses downstairs. But they turned out, there was a statistic then that if you laid the magazines flat on top of each other, the magazines that Street and Smith published every month would make a pile 44 miles high into the stratosphere. You know, I mean, it was just, and that was all, you know, they didn't send it off to a printing company in Illinois or something. They printed them in Manhattan, and they had, you know, docks in the building for the trucks. It would seem pretty impractical these days because you have to get all of those magazines off an island, you know, via tunnels or bridges.
Yeah, well, back then they had trains. The High Line was an actual train line.
Right. So, but yes, I mean, suddenly the Shadow magazine, the end of in early 42, I think 42, or was it the beginning of 43, the Shadow went from monthly, twice a month to monthly, and then by the end of the year it dropped to digest size. And that was all to conserve paper so they could print comic books at it. By 1940, I mean, the Shadow and Doc Savage's all-time peak sales were about 300,000 copies an issue or slightly under. And suddenly in 1941, Shadow Comics is selling 425,000 copies an issue. And you had all of these pulp writers moving on to comics. I mean, Alfred Bester, who wrote Captain Marvel stories. In fact, here's something you may not know. Who was writing Captain Marvel in late 40 and 1941, scripting it?
They had an awful lot of writers there. I'm not sure.
This was a couple years before Bender, and we only discovered this recently in a letter from Otto Bender to one of his friends where he mentions who had been writing Captain Marvel in 41. Henry Kuttner.
Oh.
Who wrote science fiction writer who replaced Alfred Bester as the writer of Green Lantern. Bester left in 1944, I believe, to write the Nick Carter and Shadow and Charlie Chan radio shows. And Bester, of course, he didn't so much adapt his earlier stories, but he'd use maybe a premise or the starting point of his stories and adapt them to radio and such. In number 10 of my Shadow reprints, I reprinted a story called The Immortal Murderer, in which the Shadow battles an immortal caveman, an immortal Cro-Magnon named Cain. And in another story, that one, of course, was obviously Vandal Savage reworked. Vandal Savage only had two appearances in the Golden Age, but has become a major, you know, since the Silver Age, a major villain in the DC universe, including, of course, on the Legends of Tomorrow TV series.
Yeah.
But Bester also wrote the Strange Case of Professor Radium Batman story, and he later adapted that to the Shadow and as the Man Who Was Death, so Bester would take, you know, look through his old scripts that he had done, would come up to, Julie remembered him coming up to DC and going through their library and reading his old stories to remind him of plots that he could use for his radio scripts.
Alfred Bester lived in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. And Bester also gave me all of his old Shadow radio scripts when I interviewed him to research the Shadow scrapbook. And he said, hey, you know, you're doing the book on the Shadow and you're doing research on the Shadow. And, you know, these are just taking up space. So, you know, take them. Mm-hmm. And I'm very glad to have them. But yeah, there were so many, you know, with the shift from pulp writing to comic book work, because it was much more lucrative. I mean, by 1945, Otto Binder was making, I believe, $17.50 a page for scripting comic books. Now, when you realize that in 1972 and 73, I believe Denny O'Neill at DC was getting $12 a page. You know, for 1945, you know, $17.50 a page with the amount of volume that the comic book writers were pounding out, I mean, they were making incredible money.
And yet in 75, in an interview in Legion Outpost 9, Otto Binder said he wished he had written more science fiction stories and less comic books, because science fiction stories were being reprinted in the 70s, and there were royalties being paid. And he said he'd be getting a lot more money now if he had written them then, but because comic books paid more in the 40s and 50s, he kind of wrote more comic books.
But, you know, by the same token, you can also say, I mean, how much of classic science fiction, I mean, it may have been, there was a brief period in the 60s and 70s and such when there was a lot of old classic science fiction published. I mean, when was the last time E.E. Smith's, Doc Smith's Lensman stories or Skylark stories were printed? Clifford D. Simic, who I worked with at the, you know, Minneapolis Star Tribune offices in New York. Cliff was one of the great science fiction writers, the third writer to, you know, win the Science Fiction Writers of America Grandmaster Award. And, you know, how much of his stuff is still in print?
It's
very little. Harlan Ellison, I mean, very little of his.
Yeah, it's amazing what has fallen out of print. But then even novels that were published a few months ago have fallen out of print. Publishing is such a different kind of creature nowadays.
Well, I mean, publishers gave up back at pretty much in the 80s their backlist or what? I mean, science, a lot of publishers, you know, Bantam Books made a fortune on Doc Savage. They were printing Doc Savage in the 60s and early 70s monthly with first printings of 135,000 copies. This was at a time when most science fiction paperbacks had a first printing of 10,000. But the thing is, you had, you know, publishers were happy at that time to have consistent sales. You know, I mean, they knew that if they published a science fiction paperback or a Doc Savage paperback, they'd make money. As time went along, publishers went more and more after the bestsellers, which all too often you have $1 million advance and the book doesn't, you know, earn back its advance to the writer. But it's, you know, you find very few series books out. I mean, you know, for years in the, you know, the 60s, you had the Nick Carter pulp character was reworked as Nick Carter Killmaster in a series that went, I think it was like 270 paperbacks, new paperback novels. Doc Savage reprinted all 181 of the original Doc Savage novels and also published for the first time the one that had never been published before at Bantam Books. You know, there were all these series books, and publishers enjoyed them because you had a loyal audience who was picking them up, and, you know, they might not be making a fortune on each one, but they were, making a profit.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not the case, of course. You've had a huge change in the comic books, you know. We're not seeing, you know, we're seeing, especially at DC, the continual frequent relaunching of series, you know, so they can get back with a new number one.
Well, yeah, a new number one, and plus the work-for-hire agreements make people not want to create new things as much as they used to. A lot of things going into that. And, you know, I mean, everything in print isn't selling as well as it used to. Although the last few years there's been an increase in book sales from the few years before that. But that's not saying much. I mean, sales are pretty bad.
But we'll also never see anything like the, you know, 30-year run of Kurt Swan on Superman.
I wouldn't expect that ever happen, but you never know. I mean, you never thought there'd be another million-selling novel, and then Harry Potter comes out.
What Harry Potter did for juvenile reading was just phenomenal. And, you know, really, you know, I remember, I think it was John Landis at a famous monsters convention recounting a teenager who was a friend of his family reaction when he was 12 years old or 8 years old or something, and he saw Star Wars for the first time. Because it was a revelation to him, because he had never realized that going to the movies could be fun. Because, you know, in the 70s, so many movies were like Taxi Driver and, you know, really depressive things, you know, like a lot like a DC Comics movie today. And, you know, you go to a Marvel movie, you leave the theater feeling good, you know, feeling uplifted. You go, unfortunately, to a DC movie and end up feeling drained when you leave. And I hate to say that as, you know, someone who worked for DC for over 20 years of my life. I love these characters. But, you know, we will never see the, you know, I can't imagine we'll ever see anything like Marv Wolfman's run on New Teen Titans. You know, or Dick Dillon's run on Justice League. Or,
for one thing, the books have to last that long.
Colorist, yeah. My late wife, Adrienne Roy's 17-year run on the Batman books. Or my 18 years on Green Lantern. You know, the, you know, it's everything seems flavor of the month now.
Yep. Everything
and short flavor
range.
Of the year. And, you know, and I kind of always question that, because if you keep changing it and making it different from what it was, how does that affect, you know, international reprinting when, you know, things are so dated by how they look, and you can look at it and say, oh, this is from 1989, this is from 1995. I mean, that's just, you know, I'm sure you remember seeing the internet article a year or two ago by Jerry Ordway on Comics After 50, when he went over 3 months without getting any work, even though he was under an exclusive contract. And when someone who's as good of a writer and as wonderful of a storyteller and artist is Jerry Ordway can't get work he's not what they're looking for.
Yeah, there's an incredible number of talented people who are not getting work, and it's really amazing. And how can you build a loyal and growing readership when you keep telling your readers, okay, we don't want you anymore, we want new people, and because the new people don't know that there's something new for them, and so sales keep going down and down and down. And it's amazing how they shoot themselves in the foot so often. It's just amazing. You are listening to Hour of the Wolf. Jim Freund is not here. I am subbing for him, but he'll be back next week from 1:30.
And you are?
And I am Ken Gale. I normally do Ecologic Tuesdays at 8 p.m. Talking about environmental issues, but before I did Ecologic, I was doing Nuff Say, where I interviewed writers and artists in comics. It's something I still love to do, and Jim Freund contacts me every once in a while to substitute for his show, and I really appreciate that, because I love having a chance to have conversations like we're having with Anthony Tolan right now.
Now, by the way,
and give your
getting
website.
Back to my Shadow and Doc Savage reprint.
Yes, and give your website.
My website, which is in the process of being updated, so it's a bit behind schedule, but www.shadowsanctum.com.
Repeat that.
www.shadowsanctum.com. I'm just looking right now at the cover of Shadow Volume 29 of my double novel reprints. And it features the shadow on top of a giant typewriter prop. And that story features a shadow in a room of, you know, giant, you know, oversized props. And, you know, looking at that, I think, what a great idea for a visual medium like comic books. You know, that would have worked great in Batman stories.
Right, and Bill Finger did it over and over and over again.
I know, but Walter Gibson did it in,
you don't have the
1941.
Year at your
fingertips? And
Englehart and Rogers sort of did a nod to Finger's giant typewriters in when they were doing Batman in the 70s.
You know, we talked mostly about the Shadow at this point, but I mean, you know, Doc Savage. First off, Doc Savage, you know, you talk about Clark Savage Jr., the Man of Bronze, who has a Fortress of Solitude. And you have Clark Kent, the Man of Steel, who has a Arctic Fortress of Solitude like Doc's. And you know, you have, you know, two like iconic areas of superheroes here. And I think one of the things that happened purely by chance with the Shadow, the Shadow was really, as far as I can determine, the first real dark hero in literature. And what Walter Gibson did, basically because he had this assignment of creating a, you know, mystery detective series around this sinister voice from radio, is create a iconic character who had the charisma of the melodrama villain. You know, if you look at melodramas like, you know, the Mountie and the Snidely Whiplash character, or Dracula, you know, Dracula's one of the great melodramas. Melodrama is basically the battle between good and evil. And quite frankly, in the melodrama, the most interesting character was pretty much universally the villain. I mean, who is the charisma in the novel or the play Dracula? Jonathan Harker or Dracula? And, you know, so Walter Gibson created this character who's garbed much like Dracula. Actually was the image of the spy or saboteur in popular fiction from before. And in you know, the melodramatic movie serials, for example, the person in the black slouch hat and cloak would be laughing evilly while he tied the girl down on the railroad tracks. And in the Shadow novels, when if the girl is tied to the railroad track and you hear the sinister laughter, it connotes rescue. The good guy has arrived.
Right.
So what Walter did was find a way to give the good guy, the hero of the stories, the iconic charisma of the villain. And of course, that's Batman. You know, regrettably, I mean, one of my regrets about DC is at times, certainly in the most recent movie, Batman v Superman, where Batman murders about 30 people with machine guns
yeah.
and car chases and such. You know, when you're dressed in the black outfit, you don't have to act like a bad guy. You know, you have the charisma. I mean, you know, have gun will travel. The cowboy hero who wore black, but he had his own moral code and ethics.
And a lot of Star Trek writers.
Gene Roddenberry wrote 21 episodes of
Jerome Bixby and S. Barr David. A huge number of Star Trek writers are writing Have Gun Will Travel. And I've found a lot of similarities with Adam Strange, where both characters had a gun that they never used. You know, Paladin did not use his gun very often. Occasionally he would draw it and threaten somebody and still wouldn't shoot anyone. And Adam Strange had his ray gun, and he never shot anybody. He figured out the answer.
Well, you know, that was one of the big differences between Marvel and DC Comics in the 60s, is Marvel comics were slugfests. You know, very much the Jack Kirby action, Hulk stomp, you know. Marvel a lot of times the hero won by punching it out and winning the fight that way. DC Comics, the characters tended to use their brain and outsmart the villain. You know, it was less visual, though, and Marvel had this level of action that appealed. But, you know, Marvel characters in the, you know, 60s were good. I mean, Peter Parker and, I mean, Captain America especially. And Marvel, you know, I if I can diverge from the pulps again for a moment, Ken, did you see Captain America Civil War?
No.
The movie?
No, I haven't.
Because in many ways it had the same premise of Batman v. Superman. It was Iron Man fighting Captain America. But in the Marvel film, both of them retained true to their ethics and history and, you know, personality and what they were fighting for. And they weren't just, you know, two total jerks. They were fighting for principle and not... The premise of Batman v. Superman is Bruce Wayne looks at the aftermath of the Superman Man of Steel movie and says, well, Superman saved the world from an alien invasion, but what if he goes bad sometime in the future? Well, just in case he might go bad sometime, I've got to go out and kill him now.
Yeah.
But, you know, and of course, the next question there is, okay, you go out and kill Superman now. What happens the next time there's an alien invasion? But
yeah, they're not thinking anything through. You know, we have 25 minutes left, and I bet you there are people who want to talk to you on the telephone.
Insomniacs,
yes.
Well, you know, I used to suffer from insomnia, but
fact,
I never lost any
sleep over
it.
In fact, there's somebody calling right now, so... the number here is 347-335-0818, and you're on the air.
Hey, Ken, it's Robert. Remember me? We talked folklore of comic books heroes once, and westerns.
Yes, okay, yeah, when you brought up westerns, now I remember the conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway,
Anthony Tolan, I have so many questions. By the way, the idea of turning Superman bad... In an episode of the Justice League, that's exactly what Darkseid did. He programmed Superman, and Superman led the invasion of Apocalypse on Earth in one of the Justice League. But I have some origin questions I want to ask you guys. You mentioned one of my favorite villains. What was the origin, sirs, of Vandal Savage? I loved him.
Well, I'm sure it came from, you know, I'm sure there were... similar things. In fact, I think it's mentioned in our books. I think there are some science fiction predecessors of Vandal Savage, some immortal men in science fiction from the pulp tradition.
I mean, he was marvelous. I mean, the whole idea that he was, quasi-immortal, again, although in one episode, again, of Justice League, and I do have a Justice League question, an origin question, in one episode, Superman got shoved 30,000 years into the future by Toy Man, and it turns out... By the way, I'm very curious. You mentioned the... have you seen Supergirl?
I love Supergirl.
Okay, I want to ask you a question. Do you happen to remember the original name or the name of the Toy Man? Because I have a feeling that his son is one of the good guys.
Oh, no. Yes, that is. They even had the Toy Man on the series.
Wind Shock or something, right?
Wind's father is the Toy Man, and he's appeared on the series.
Oh, he has appeared on the series?
During the first season, yes.
Oh, I missed it. Okay. Now I have
I want to add something to the immortal characters, because in Gulliver's Travels, 1726,
yes,
Jonathan Swift has immortal characters in there.
Oh, he does?
Yeah. In Gulliver's Travels, he goes to many different islands. And there's even little maps, as if you could go to them, too.
Well, one of the interesting things about Gulliver's...
A lot of Gulliver's Travels is satire of other literature that existed at the time. He makes fun of the Royal Society, the scientific writing in one chapter. But the point is that the immortal characters, he's playing on what people assume of immortal characters. And so clearly there were many immortal characters in other bits of fiction of the time for him to play on them.
Can I? I've just opened up my Shadow Volume 10, which featured a foreword by Harlan Ellison. But I'm looking at my article where I introduced the Immortal Murderer, the story that was reworked by Alfred Bester.
Yeah, now you mentioned...
And I note in my introductory article there that Vandal Savage was most likely inspired by the character of Cardophilus in George Sylvester Viereck and Paul Eldridge's 1928 novel, My First 2,000 Years,
oh my.
The Autobiography of the Wandering Jew, and also by the curse of immortality imposed in myth upon Ixion, Tantalus, and Sisyphus.
Yes, and now you're in my ballpark because my specialization is comparative global folklore, myth, and legend. But I want to ask you a couple of other origin questions because I know you probably have a few other people you want to talk to.
By the way, you mentioned Justice League. If you remember the wonderful Steve Englehart story, the origin of the Justice League minus one.
Yes, now I want to ask you...
In Justice League number 144, I was a color artist on that story.
Can you tell me...
I remember Tony was so happy that he got to create the color scheme for Manhunter in Englehart's Justice League.
You mean Martian Manhunter?
No, no.
No, no, the Manhunter who was a member of the Man eventually became, internet. There was briefly a Justice League supporting character called Manhunter.
And I want to ask you...
Well, hold on. Steve Englehart wrote Justice League for less than a year, but probably the best Justice League stories ever. And
mm-hmm.
when the scripts came into DC, whoever got them would yell into the hallway, "New Englehart," and everybody would come running out of their office to look at it. And he
also wrote some of the best Batman stories.
Oh, absolutely.
Detective Comics run.
My favorite of any Batman I've ever read. I'm a huge Bill Finger fan. He had to send a letter asking people, don't use Manhunter and Brave and Bold or any other series I have plans for him. And so Tony's pride of creating the cover scheme got dashed when the plans were finally realized.
By the way, I do have another origin question.
Mm-hmm.
We know about the Justice League. Can you tell me very quickly, Anthony Tolan, the origin of the Justice Society of America? Because they're not the same organization, are they?
No, that's, we said in Earth 2, but the World War II heroes, and by the way, the Justice League of America just debuted in last night's episode of Legends of Tomorrow.
They did?
Yeah, at the very end, the Justices, they're back in time in 1942 when the Justice Society appear in the final scene. And, so watch it next week or whatever the next episode is.
Are you talking about the episode of Legends of Tomorrow that will be on tonight?
No, it aired last night.
Oh, it aired last night. Oh, jeez, I missed it. Oh, sorry. Okay.
It aired on Tuesday night, right. And it's moving to Tuesday night.
It is moving to Tuesday night, so they're replacing Flash?
They're making room for... they're making room for... Riverdale, an Archie Andrews series on Thursday night.
Oh, okay. I just want to ask a couple of other quick things. You mentioned Zorro. What was the origin of Zorro in print? Now, here's the reason. I remember Zorro, of course, from the Disney from the 50s with Guy Williams.
Which is the one TV series from my childhood that really lives up to my memory of it.
Oh,
it
I loved it. I loved it.
Series.
Well, but he came out of the – did he come out of the pulps? Zorro?
Yes, Zorro first appeared in 1919 in the serialized novel The Curse of Capistrano by Johnston McCulley. And then Zorro appeared in a number of sequels in Argosy and then was featured every month in West Magazine in the 40s.
Yes, that I remember.
How many Zorro novels came out back then?
Oh, I think there were like 5 novels and 56 short stories or something.
Hmm.
But quite frankly, I'd say Zorro is kind of an anomaly, because Zorro is like the character I'd really cite as a character who was almost always better in other mediums than he was in his original stories. And I think the pinnacle is the Disney series.
Did you ever see, Anthony, did you ever see any of the Zorro serials? I am especially referring to the Zorro Rides Again, where Richard Alexander, who of course was Prince Baron on the Flash Gordon
And of course serials. Ghost of Zorro with Clayton Moore wearing a mask before
and
he
joined
it as the Lone Ranger.
By the way, he wasn't, by the way, his name wasn't even Diego de la Vega. His name in that was Ken Mason. But one of my favorites was Zorro's Fighting Legion, which takes place in Mexico during the presidency of Benito Juarez, and he's trying to save it from, now get the name of this villain, Don Del Oro, the King of Gold. I mean, this is stuff that they don't do anymore. And one other question. You mentioned Captain America. Did either of you ever see the 1940s? I love cliffhanger serials. I own about 130 of them in my film collection. And I love the villains. The Crimson Ghost, Mysterious Dr. Satan, the Shark, all those wonderful. Did you ever see either the Shadow serial with Victor Jory, Columbia, or the original Batman 1943 with J. Carroll Nash? By the way, you could never show that today. Never.
Yeah, see, I've seen all of them. I've seen both Batman serials.
I'm going to take you out, Robert, so somebody else can call.
Okay. Good luck.
If I may make one last thing about Zorro. And that is that, you know, Bob Kane for years claimed that Zorro was the main influence on the creation of Batman. And yet there's really virtually nothing of Zorro in the first year of Batman. You know, the grim Batman mimics the somber Shadow, not the devil may care Caballero. Mm-hmm. And Bruce Wayne's actions parallel Lamont Cranston's and not the effete behavior of Don Diego. The relationship with the police commissioner is, again, from... not from Zorro, it's from the Shadow.
Right.
So, okay, Ken, let's talk to the next listener.
347-335-0818. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Yes, I wanted to say actually two things. One was I was surprised when you mentioned that Gene Roddenberry wrote, you said many episodes. Did you say 21 episodes for Have Gun Will Travel?
Yes, Have Gun Will Travel.
I'm not sure. Yeah, so that represents what, maybe a third of them or a quarter of them or something like that?
Well, it ran for 6 years.
6 years.
And they had 39 episodes a year back then.
Right.
Ah, right. But
just to mention briefly, Gene Roddenberry was the press agent and publicist. He was a lieutenant for the LAPD and was the person who was... the speechwriter and such for Chief Parker, and he was assigned to review the Dragnet radio scripts and later the Dragnet TV scripts. And that's where he started taking the scripts home and then listening, watching the TV show and learning what a lap dissolve was and a fade and such. And then he had the similar duty a year or so later on the Mr. District Attorney TV show, and he wrote his first scripts and sold them.
How about that? I had no idea that was his history. But what I wanted to say about Have Gun Will Travel, now, I used to watch this in the 50s as a little girl with my father, and I mostly watched it because he watched it. I never really liked it, and I think what I didn't like about it was, I'm watching it differently from the way a grown man is watching it, and I didn't like the way he related to women. Now, putting aside the racism, too, of the hey boy thing, but the way he related to women, it was so cold. I found him cold. I found the scripts cold. You know, he was always making a date with some other, you know, he had a different woman every week, and half the time he broke the date anyway because, you know, he'd tell hey boy, go tell her she's waiting for me. Going to have dinner, and I can't make it, you know? Or sometimes he'd come back and they'd have champagne. But it was never the same woman. He never saw the same woman 2 weeks in a row. Do you remember that?
Well, it's interesting.
Yes, and there's a funny story in the casting of that where the casting director for the show sent a telegram to the head of the network, the president of the network, saying, what do you think of Richard Boone? And the president of the network replied, Richard Boone is the ugliest actor in the business.
Yeah,
and the agent, the casting director, wrote back, telegrammed back, congratulations, you just signed the ugliest actor in the business.
Oh, really?
Well,
yeah,
the first Gene Roddenberry episode of Have a Gun, Will Travel had a very strong woman character in it.
Really?
And a very clever way of defeating the bad guy, and there was social commentary in it. It was fascinating.
That's true.
Henderson turned me on to Have Gun, Will Travel, telling me that the writing was excellent, and I totally agree with her, and I've thanked her several times for cluing me in.
And have you seen Genesis, the origin episode, the season opener from the fifth season?
I've only seen the first four seasons, because I got my episodes from the library, and they only had the first 4 years.
The origin episode, Genesis, is just phenomenal. And
he did sort of, I guess, go to the aid of women in trouble. Those women probably were portrayed differently, but the way he related to women, this scene was always, oh, please tell her I can't make it, And then when he did make it, it was just another woman every week. And, he never got any further with these women. It was just one different woman every week, as opposed to, let's say, Gunsmoke, a totally different thing, where you could see that Matt Dillon really cared about Kitty, and they had this great relationship ongoing every week.
The original Gunsmoke radio show, it was much clearer that Kitty was the local madam.
But they had a great relationship. And speaking of the original Gunsmoke, you're talking about the radio now, right?
Yeah. With William Conrad as Matt Dillon, yes.
Yes. Now, I wish they had cast William Conrad in the role. I know he was too short, but James Arness couldn't act his way out of a paper bag, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, there were very few 6'6" marshals in the Old West. And, while William Conrad does not meet with our imagined image of a Western marshal, he probably resembles real Western marshals a lot more than... James
probably. Yeah, but what a great actor. I mean, I just love him on the radio. But you know what? I wanted to ask one other thing. Ken, that's your name, right? Well, no,
yeah.
It's 3 o'clock in the morning. What's your name?
Ken and Anthony.
Right. Well, you did a show maybe a year ago, actually. And you brought back a memory I had completely forgotten. You've got an idea now. Since I've been talking about the shows I watched in the 50s, you have some idea what era I'm from. And you mentioned a comic book that I had completely forgotten, and it brought back such nostalgia for me, and it was Little Lulu. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Sure, John Stanley, and then...
Written by John Stanley, who was one of the greats.
And Arnold Drake took over Little Lulu from John Stanley. Arnold Drake wrote a lot of stuff for both Marvel and DC.
And I had completely forgotten that comic book. It was my very favorite, and I can't remember. And I started to remember things. I think somebody mentioned the name Aunt Fritzy. She lived with Aunt Fritzy, right? Fritzy Ritz.
Right. Yeah.
Why was she living with Aunt Fritzy? Was she an orphan or something?
Nancy, I think she was adopted by her aunt, yeah.
Yeah, back then, everybody was aunts and uncles and nieces and nephews. It didn't seem that anybody had their own children.
Or ward.
Nobody had their own children.
I guess what I liked about her, first she was cute, she had this little curl, in the middle of her forehead or something, and she never seemed to be in any bad trouble, and I'm trying to remember I can't remember any plot lines or anything. I mean, like, for example, the other shows, like Dennis the Menace, Nancy and Sluggo, I'd never liked them because they were always in trouble. So Little Lulu seemed to always be perfect. So what would
it was Nancy, I believe, who was Fritzy Ritz's niece. Little Lulu actually, I think, was originated in Saturday Evening Post cartoons.
Yes.
Oh.
By Marge.
Yeah. Little Lulu was a one-panel comic strip in Saturday Evening Post. And Nancy was the niece of Fritzy Ritz. And Fritzy Ritz had her own comic strip. And then Nancy took it over. And Fritzy Ritz was kind of relegated to a supporting character. But it was originally her strip. She was a flapper.
Oh.
You know, talking about earlier, about pulp influences, not only was Doc Savage a major influence on Superman, But one of the things Joe Shuster explained was that what Jerry Siegel really did in creating Superman was reverse the concept of John Carter of Mars by Edgar Rice Burroughs, where it was Earthman.
I'll leave it for someone else, okay? Let somebody else call in. Thank you so much. It was fun to talk to you. Bye-bye.
And I should mention one other thing about Have Gun, Will Travel is the treatment of Native Americans. They were never, ever the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
It was amazing to think in 57 to 62 or something like that, and the Native Americans never started any of the fights. If there was a fight with them, it was a white guy started it, usually out of bigotry. It was amazing to see that, thinking that, oh, well, the 50s are so backward and things like that. You know, the 50s are not as backward as people like to think they were.
Are there any more callers on the line, Ken?
Not yet. It takes a few minutes because of the 10-second delay, and then people have to call in. So there's always going to be a gap between one caller and the next. 347-335-0818. We only have time for one more caller. So whoever it is, you're going to be it. And Anthony, give the website for the Shadow reprints and the Doc Savage reprints.
www.shadowsanctum.com. Sanctum is, of course, S-A-N-C-T-U-M. www.shadowsanctum.com. But it's badly in need of updating. We're now up to just printed earlier today was volume 113 of my Shadow novels, also at two annuals. So as of this time, I have reprinted 235 Shadow novels and all 182 Doc Savage novels. By the way...
and we do have another caller.
Okay.
So let's go. 347-335-0818. You're on the air.
Very, very good morning to you guys. Listen, you're talking about my childhood, first of all, but you're leaving out the most important criteria. Listen, these were programs that we sat around the radio as a family around the fireplace. Mm. The work in the house still went on, but everybody knew when it was time for the shows to come on, and we gathered as a family. I thank you so much, because this delights me in my age of this time to know that, yes, I'm a character of all of those phenomenons, but I ideally love the part that the family comes together and sits around the fireplace. We need to bring that back, America.
And I also think, one of the things I realize is that in my own childhood, though I was a child of the 1950s television age, we were watching the same shows, the Jack Benny Show and the Lone Ranger and the Adventures of Superman and, you know, the Burns and Allen Show.
Absolutely.
And we were watching it as a family, partly because we had generally only three channels plus the PBS station in the 60s.
I Love Lucy with the little color pad that you put over it. If you didn't have color TV, it was a kind of the same thing that they use in arts and crafts in school, made of plastic with red, purple, with the colors of the rainbow, but really the darkened part of the colors of the rainbow. And that was enjoyable also.
But back then, we had only one TV in the house, so the whole family watched it, and we watched the same thing.
That's why we gathered. Ideally, and this is what I'm saying, America, we need to bring that back. What's wrong with you? We need to bring the family back together with one idiom that we all support.
Well, with the number of single-family parents, so the one parent has to work, it's a very different culture now.
Oh, absolutely.
I don't think we could bring it back, although that would be nice.
Well, but then now, I differ with you because I'm also a comic book fanatic, all right? We traded them. You know, that's when they were Nickel America. Stop playing with me. I know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
We have to understand that, no, it's not going to happen overnight. But if that becomes the so-called the changing of America, then let's do it together. Hello, America.
Okay. Well, I'm going to have to let that be the last word because we are out of time.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
God bless you.
Thanks for your call. And thank you, Anthony Tolan, for this wonderful hour and a half in the middle of the night.
Well, it's great talking with you again, Ken, and hope to see you again one of these decades.
One of these decades, yeah. And
although, you know, I mean, like the shadow, I mean, we've been never seen, only heard in regard to the other for some decades now.
Right. And coming up next is Lister with Burn Baby Burn. And so stay tuned to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. And you'll be able to hear all of this show on the archives in about 5 or 10 minutes. Take care.
Why doesn't it come? Why doesn't it come?
Were you waiting for me, Dan Malley?
Who's that? Who spoke?
The Shadow.
The Shadow?
There isn't much time, Malley. They're coming after you to take you to the chair. Speak quickly. What have you to say?
Just this. For the best in old-time radio thrills, adventure, and comedy, tune in to the Golden Age of Radio, 7 to 9, Sunday nights, right here on WBAI New York.
WBAI's environmental show Ecologic is on every other Tuesday evening. Listen to scientists, activists, authors, and other experts discuss public policy and give you information on topics such as climate change, air, water, environmental justice, energy, both poisonous and renewable, healthy food, wildlife, transportation, green buildings, and of course, connections with other issues. You'll always find out what you can do to make the environment better, and every show starts with news and announcements on environmental actions. With your host, Ken Gale, every other Tuesday at 8 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone?
Hi, I'm Ken Gale of WBAI's Tuesday evening environmental show Ecologic. One of the cool things about being a BAI buddy is that you get to decide what WBAI is worth to you. Are we worth more than your cable TV? Or $10 a month, $20, $100, $1 million. Just go to the WBAI.org website and sign up with your credit card. You'll barely notice it. In return, you get a WBAI tote bag to show off, free or discounted entry to special WBAI events, and other perks. Another cool thing about being a BAI buddy is less fundraising interruptions to your favorite programs. Go to WBAI.org. You can donate in the name of your favorite show, like Ecologic.
WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
When I leave, you're going to know my said with the last words on my lips. I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to spell it. I am a proletarian. I am
a fish. The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth that's off the way I see it? Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, though that's my right, and it's right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ashes.
where the real meaning is, what the message must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Number one,
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, and forget Korea, Beirut, and forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talk about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central, LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
Y no podés
simular. Cuando calma, qué preciados son, me iluminó en tu amor, princesita mía, siempre estoy con vos. ¿Será que sos un ángel? Wow. Y no podés disimular. ¿Será que sos un ángel?
To Rather Station, WBAI, Lister on the radio, burning the imperious red, white, and blue to ashes before 5 o'clock. And if it won't burn, we'll dip it in an acid, yeah. My music, they refuse to play on imperious radio.
My music is so.